Blog Talk Radio.
My brothers and my sisters, and welcome once again to the PRF table. And I'm your host, Dr. Dunlap. Also sitting here at the table is none other than Adia Sanders. Adia, how are you doing this evening?
I am doing super, and I'm so glad to be here on today.
Good deal, good deal. Well, look, this is February the 4th, 2016, and we are entering to a new season for the month. If you've been with us for the last month, you know last month we were dealing with financial healing, and now we are just really into a whole something different right now. Right now we're going to be talking with several guests that we have this evening, or one that we have this evening, and several that we're going to have during this whole particular month. And we're really doing something new that we haven't never done before here on the last couple of years here on the PRF table. We've never dealt with Black History Month as a month. We've never dealt with it in the way that we're going to deal with it today, and also for the rest of 3 weeks in this month. So tonight's episode, we're dealing with social entrepreneurship, and we have a special guest that is going to be talking to us in a few moments about social entrepreneurship and what does it mean, especially inside of the Black community. But before we even get to the Black part, we got to have an understanding of what social entrepreneurship is. And so for that, again, thank everybody for being with us last month. We hope everybody takes the time out to be with us, not just for tonight, but also for the rest of the 3 weeks. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about our guest for tonight. I know I'm excited. I know if Mama was on, Mama would be excited. I know a couple of other people. I know he's excited. But we have one of the nation's leading social entrepreneurs. And his name is none other than Earl Martin Salen. This brother has done some tremendous and great things. And, you know, he's a humble person. So all these flowering things that I'm saying are things that he's done and his accomplishments. And I just think that as a Black person dealing with what we're dealing with this month, uplifting Black history, not just as a month, but uplifting the accomplishment of somebody who looks like me, I will say, not everybody, but looks like me, has done. So Earl has founded the George and Veronica Phelan Leadership Academies and also Summer Advantage. And we'll let him tell a little bit about the things that he's done. But for right now, let us just welcome Earl Martin Phelan to the show. Earl, how are you doing this evening?
Doing great. It's great to be here with you and Adia and all of those who are on the phone.
Amen. Well, what I wanted to do was really with Adia's help is really kind of set the stage for, you know, why we're even talking about this. And what happened really as we were preparing last month for this month's show, God just really spoke to me and said, you know what, Black people have done a lot of great things in this country. And we know we're coming up on Black History Month. And we know what Black History Month means to a lot of Black people in this country. It is a time to celebrate the achievements. It's a time to have gatherings and uplift each other. And we all know, especially those of us who are Black, because everybody who listens to the show and participates with the show is not a Black person. But we know that sometimes we get into this thing about the month, and we forget about what's going on for the rest of the 11 months before it comes back around. Sometimes we deal with Black History Month and we look so far back in the past and we never take an opportunity, Earl, to look at what's going on here in the present day. You know, I have children and my baby girl, she's 19 years old. She may not relate to Martin Luther King. So if we can't bring and present something to her of present age or of something that is more to her liking or something that's more interesting than the historical context that we want them to have, they're really not going to have. And I can tell you, there's a couple of books that I started reading. One of them is called The Rise and Fall of Black Wall Street, and the other one is called actually Black Wall Street. And for those who don't know, I'm not going to try to give a whole complete history lesson, but just to set the stage, back in the late 1800s, early 1920s, Black people in this country, particularly in the place of North Tulsa, Oklahoma, they owned a lot of things. They were business owners. Many of them were millionaires. And North Tulsa was like a black Mecca, if you will. And ironically, we were, I won't say a self-contained unit, but we were, in so many words, or we were a self-contained unit. Everything that we needed was right in our community. And so it started me thinking, what can we do? And this is the theme that we're using for the whole month. What can we take from the past? What lessons from the past can we take, embrace them, and see that they operated under some very good principles, even though it may have been almost 100 years ago? But what did they do back then that we can actually learn from and bring it to the present age? Because honestly, from what I see, black people are lagging behind in a lot of areas, especially when it comes to entrepreneurship, especially when it comes to home ownership. We talked about it on the show before. We said, look, you don't own your home until you actually get that deed, until you don't have a mortgage. That's when you own it. So, you know, society will say you're a homeowner. Well, no, you're not a homeowner as long as you have a note on it. But what about people who own land? There's a young brother who went out to his property, and I looked and saw all the land that he had down here in Alabama. But the people who own the land right across will never sell their land. And so it's this old, dilapidated house right across the street from them on the property, but they won't sell it. See, evidently they know something that maybe the persons who want to buy it don't know. When you own something, it puts you in a position for other things. And so I really wanted to bring Adia into the conversation, because Adia has some things that she wanted to bring out from a historical context. And let's just spend a couple of minutes. And Earl, if you have any questions or comments, please jump in. And then I'll mention a couple of things about what was going on in the 1920s, and then hit it hard with social entrepreneurship. So, Adia, I'll let you take it away.
All right. Well, once again, good evening, everyone. I am by no means a history, whatever you want to call it, but I love history, minored in history, and undergrad, and definitely have appreciation for all types of history, because it lets us know about our past. And so when we were developing, I guess, the topic and where we were going to go for the month of February, also known as Black History Month, talking about how money matters and that of black people, money matters, just really resonated in my soul, to where it was important to me to kind of capture the pre-slavery African economics and what that looked like. And I got the opportunity to talk to a instructor of mine from Command General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, who is a who has studied African history for probably over 20 years. Has gone over to Africa, and he provided me with some information, and also a classmate of mine from school as well, who is from Nigeria, Africa. And the information that was provided definitely helped to put into perspective about black economics or African economics and how that kind of tied in. So I was sharing with Nate one of the a portion of what a friend of mine sent me. His name is Eric, and what he was sharing was that the economic status in Africa prior to 1500, not a lot of information was provided, but what really stood out to me, without going into a lot of detail, was what he said was understanding the resources and the value of those resources that were possessed during that time, and that, you know, the tribes and villages, they mostly traded amongst themselves, and they shared what they had with one another. And I was, you know, just sharing with Nate that reminded me of Acts, how the people came together and as a community, as a united front, to say that we're going to put all of our resources together and we will share them. And so I what I see when it comes to, I guess, how our money matters in the black community is the sharing of resources. And so when you fast forward to the Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Greenwood community, you saw the exact same efforts and behaviors being duplicated. And I just think it's important, you know, that when we look at the wealth or the economics of those villages, that they, what you said was that they weren't always based on tangible things, but it was assessed by the population and the capabilities of its youth in repopulating and protecting the integrity of the community, and just how it wasn't always, I guess, viewed or, you know, compared to always, you know, monetary things, but being able to come together and being a community. And I just think sometimes it's important, you know, that when we look at our Black history, that we understand that where our Black history comes from. Our Black history definitely has so many roots and traditions that are here in the United States, but there was a start, there was a beginning of where it came from. And if you, you know, not a scientist, but if I'm pretty sure that if we had a study that was done on the Africans before 1500, slavery, and the Black African Americans today, I'm pretty sure that the study probably would show definitely DNA, genetic, and behavior similarities without ever having a connection to Africa. And I just think, you know, how it ties in so, just ties in perfectly with Tulsa, Oklahoma, about the sharing of the resources and things that were of value and what they possessed. And we see in Tulsa, Oklahoma, those things that they had, it meant something to them. It was of value to be a business owner and to know that the resources and the services that you were providing were to people that looked like you, and you weren't trying to take anything from them. You weren't trying to, you know, charge them an outrageous amount, but you wanted to be able to help them, and you wanted to be able to keep those resources within your community, because sometimes, you know, we are all that we have, and I think that that's important. I also just, you know, would like to tie in, you know, when you look at Africa as far as economics, some of the things that were constraints and limitations were just the natural terrain features. You have the rivers and jungles and deserts and things. So it was easier for them to be able for those resources to be kept where they were, whereas today, you know, our constraints and limitations aren't rivers and jungles, but sometimes they are based on our education level. They're based on, if it's not education level, the knowledge that we have when it comes to our money and what that can do for us, you know. And I just think it's important that we embrace all of our history and knowing how it all ties together. That can definitely help us in the 21st century and moving ahead. And that's all that I have for now, Nate.
And Adia, one of the things I think that you said was so powerful, which really ties into everything that we do here at PRF, is the fact that you mentioned about community and having a sense of community. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the two beacons of scripture that really sit on the side and uplift this ministry, one is 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 1 through 7, and the other one is Acts chapter 2, verses 42 to 47, when the believers came together and they shared everything that they had, and they sold their property and possessions so that nobody had a need. Those type of things is what we're looking for. And we have to do things a little bit different. The thing with that scripture that I just read to you is it doesn't tell you how. It leaves a whole bunch of things out. It doesn't say who actually had the possessions. It doesn't say who they sold the possession to. It doesn't say all of that. So we have to be smart enough as a people to really come together and say, okay, what is it that I can do? And just to bring something up about, excuse me, North Tulsa and Black Wall Street, they had when you go back and you look at it, they had like 600 different types of businesses in one section of a city, not throughout the whole city, not throughout the whole state, but in a whole section of a city. And these consisted of banks. They had at least one mega church there. They had public school. They had libraries. They had hospitals, all within their community. And so I really believe, and Earl, I really want to just start talking to you now, that when we talk about social entrepreneurship, I don't know if we can even get there without even having a good understanding of what entrepreneurship really is, without
yes.
having something to bring into the conversation and say, this is what entrepreneurship is. And I have to be bold and say, because y'all know how I do, selling bootleg DVDs. Some may question if that's true entrepreneurship, but yet the brother's still making a whole bunch of money, or he thinks. But what can he really do with that business? Illegal drugs. May make a lot of money, but what can you really do to that with that business? Can you really pass that down to your children's children? So, Earl, I'm about to pass it to you. I really think that, you know, hearing from somebody like yourself who has been in this world, in this industry, in this mode, this model of service that you have even developed, maybe we can start there with helping us and those who are listening to get an understanding of what true entrepreneurship is, because I don't know if you can be a social entrepreneur without having an understanding of entrepreneurship in general. So I want to just turn it over to you, Earl, because you were so gracious to give us your time tonight and let you just,
you
especially just, you know, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do to give the people a good understanding of who we have on this show tonight.
Sure. I'll go short on the ladder, but just say that I've been blessed to, find my calling, which is what, you know, Nate described as social entrepreneurship. And social entrepreneurship, let me back up, entrepreneurship is really that commitment to start and grow a business. And in growing a business, Nate, you mentioned the drug dealer, you mentioned the person who sells illegal cigarettes.
Right.
You may not have mentioned the hairdresser or whomever, but the entrepreneur, and there are thousands of entrepreneurs in every community, in our community and beyond. The entrepreneur is, I'm willing to take a risk. I'm not going to go take a job with a secure salary because I think I have a salary. I mean, I think I have a service that if I build the business in the right way, hiring the right people, opening the storefront, being willing to go through the legal pieces that you have to do to build a business, struggling through hiring the right people or not the right people, getting some startup capital when you need to get the resources to start the business, and figuring all that out. The entrepreneur is the person who says, I'll fight through all the startup challenges of a business, and I think I can lead, and I'm confident enough I can lead myself and whomever I bring on my team to build a profitable business. So that's the entrepreneur. And 99% of entrepreneurs in the United States right now are small businesses. They're 99% are under $1 million, and they're bringing in that money, and they have to worry about having enough enough cash for payroll. And they have to worry about paying their landlord because they're leasing space for their program or what have you. The social entrepreneur, it's really hard. It's really hard to be an entrepreneur, and that's why 3 out of 5 entrepreneurs fail in the first 5 years, and 4 of 5 entrepreneurs fail within the first 10 years. So it's really hard. It's hard stuff. A social entrepreneur adds a complexity on top of that, which is my first bottom line, right? So if an entrepreneur's bottom line is, I want to make more than I spend, very simply, and that's profit. Mm-hmm. A social entrepreneur says, I have 2 bottom lines. One is to do something for society that advances, that makes society, makes my community, makes my neighborhood better. And the second is, and I need to make sure that I have enough money in the bank to continue to do that the next year and the next year and the next year. So you mentioned George and Veronica Phelan Leadership Academy is named after my mom and dad. Those are schools. They're public charter schools. And we have the responsibility of first and foremost, running a program, an educational program, that helps children grow 1.5 years every school year, because our kids are coming to us below grade level. They're coming behind, and we're saying we're going to prepare you. Our job is to prepare you to be successful in middle school, in high school, in college, and in life. And so 1.5 years is only one equation, obviously, the academic equation, not talking about the social and emotional development that has to occur that will prepare you for success. But we also have to worry about the other bottom line, which is we can't pour all of our resources into making sure you grow by that much, but then at the end of the day, we can't pay our teachers, and we can't rent, and we can't pay for curriculum. So the social entrepreneur has that double responsibility and double complexity, which is harder than the entrepreneur, which is I got to make money. At the end of the day, I have to bring in more than I spend. The social entrepreneur has to bring in more than they spend, but they also have to make sure that they, even more important than the financial piece, they have to make sure that they're actually make the outcome, the academic outcome in our case of schools and in educational programs, the educational outcomes have to be something that we're all proud of. So that's the complexity of being a social entrepreneur. And again, the most entrepreneurs fail because they don't have the grit, they don't have the determination, but they also don't have the capital, the access to capital that many others have. And capital is, I will give you $100,000 to launch this barbershop. I'll give you $100,000 to launch this after-school program. But at the end of it, I want to get my $100,000 back plus a small interest, 5%, 10%. When you look at a presidential candidate, Donald Trump, and when you watch his life story, he failed miserably. He lost hundreds of millions of dollars of investor money on several of his early projects. But because of his social network, he was able, when the Trump Towers became available, even after failing, he was able to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, $850 million, to invest in Trump Towers, offering a great promise to every investor. And it was a huge success. The investors made a boatload. Trump made a boatload, and he had success. But let me be clear. He got access, after failing as a social entrepreneur on several ventures, he got access to hundreds of millions of dollars on the bet that those who invested might get 20% back, 50% back, or double their money within 2, 3, and 5 years. And so a big part of our community's challenge is the access to capital. And I'm not going to make it a racial thing, because there are many Koreans who immigrate into this country with nothing. But the Korean community says, we're going to trust you. We're going to pool our resources. We'll provide free housing in the short term. We'll give you a loan, but understand you have to pay back this loan because it's a community fund. And we're going to hold you highly accountable. But those who have resources, give it to others within the Korean community. And when you see the startup model of many of the dry cleaning businesses, the individuals who are starting those businesses needed $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 to launch those businesses, but they came to the country a year and a half ago with nothing, not even the ability to speak English, but they had a community that said, I'm going to embrace you. I'm going to get you into good schools that help your children acclimate to the culture of the United States and learn the language and learn the culture and learn the social mores. And I'm also going to provide you with capital to build a business that will allow you, and you better employ others within the community that will allow you to run a healthy business that employs others and then all of a sudden bolsters the entire economic condition. And I think that, you know, Adia said it, and I'll stop talking. Said it. When there was segregation, and I'm not an advocate for going back to those times, but when there was segregation, the black dollar cycled 8.5 times within the black community before it left. So I got paid. I went to the black barber. The black barber invested because they were paying rent to a black landowner and landlord. The black landlord was investing in it was 8.5 times the dollar cycled within the black community. Now we have the lowest cycle rate of any community within the United States, and we are literally less than one time. So as soon as we get the dollar, our dollars are going out to buy Nikes, to buy the extra cable station, to buy the 62-inch TV, and that money, I don't care if you spend it, but if you spend it and you're not spending it in a way that's going to recycle in our community to create more jobs, then understand that you're actually undermining the economic health of the black community, which is, as an economic indicator, if you took the black community, it's larger than many nations throughout the country in terms of economic power. The way we use it is absolutely paltry in terms of what the potential could be. So I'll stop talking at this point, and sorry for going so long.
Oh, no. This is why you're here. Let me tell you what's really interesting. Two things. What you said about the way that our money does not cycle within our own community, Shatara Sherwood, one of the other hosts of the show, said that last week when we were gearing up for tonight's show. She sent us some information about that. So there's some of us that know that, that can see it, that are not cool with it. The thing now is for those who – it has to matter. See, and maybe this is me. Maybe it just doesn't matter to a lot of people. And if it doesn't matter to a lot of people, then they're not going to change any of their behaviors. So it's up to us, and I know what you do already, Earl, but it's up to all of us, and I'm speaking to the listening audience. When you hear that, if that doesn't cause the hairs on your neck to stand up and say, this is ridiculous, 8.5 times it used to come and be cycled within our own community, but now is almost non-existent, that should make black people feel bad. And I'm not trying to bring that out like that, but there's no other way to say it. That should make us feel bad that that's what's happening in our black community. And as a caveat, I do recognize that a lot of us don't live strictly in black communities. But what I'll say to that is, and throw on top of that is, just because some of us don't live in a completely black community, we're still part of the black community. We're still part of it. And there was something else that you said about Donald Trump. Adia, I think Adia may remember, we brought this up last year, the same thing that you're saying right now, Earl, about relationship and how I think we were talking about credit. Matter of fact, it was one of the lessons that we were dealing with in credit, with credit last summer, and how Donald Trump, when he failed miserably, just like you said, he was still able to get credit because of his name.
Yes.
Because of his name. So he did some things. They didn't work so well. That's not the issue, that they didn't work so well. We fail sometimes. It doesn't always work the way we want it to work. Even going through education, like I went through, there were some things that during my research that I thought was going to work, and it didn't work, so I had to change the plan up. I'm trying to tell folks that that's okay if you have to change it up a little bit. But the fact that he kept going. And so now we hear this we hear from you, Earl, which was reiterating something that we said last year on the show about Donald Trump. We hear about the Koreans. Y'all know I grew up in Philly, and we had a lot of Asians that owned a lot of businesses in our communities. So at some point in time, we have to get it as black people and say, okay, what are we going to do different? one of the things that – let me ask you this, Earl, because my thought process is in order to do something like you were talking about with social as a social entrepreneur or being involved in that type of what I call service, there has to be something inside of you before you get into it. A lot of times I hear this. I hear, if I hit the lotto, then I'll do this. If I get that good job, then I'll do that. But my thought process is, and you can feel free to correct me if I'm wrong or add or take away from it, but I'm just thinking for somebody to be a social entrepreneur, there has to be something already on the inside of you that has a heart for people. I get kind of leery sometimes at people who all of a sudden when they have certain things and they've built these enterprises just on the entrepreneur side, and then they're now all of a sudden giving money away. Well, that may be good, but how far are you going to go? Because the purpose is not really the social side. That's something that comes afterwards. So how do we kind of dissect, you know, those who are doing are engaged in philanthropy from those who are social entrepreneurs? Or is there even any type of distinguishable difference?
I think that to distinguish is incredibly hard. I think that there are those who have accumulated wealth, some in pure and honest and great ways and some in questionable ways, right? Look at a lot of the institutions that exist, and if you really follow the chain, you might realize that there's very little big money that has come purely, right? If you look at Carnegie and then you track it to Chinese labor and the building of railroads, right, slave labor. And the building, so I could go through the list of about 100 big names that are on institutions that we often go to, we may take our children to, but yet that was come from money that was built off the back of our ancestors or other ancestors. So I think that tracking that is extremely difficult. But I think that the social entrepreneur says, I have a passion to do something for, in my case, for children. And I realized that when my first organization, Bell, named after Professor Derrick Bell, who was first tenured black faculty member at Harvard Law School, and he had such courage and such virtue and such values that he said, I am leaving Harvard Law School if they do not make a woman of color a tenured status. And Harvard was saying, oh, we can't find a qualified woman of color. And he said, nonsense. Here's a list of 10. Here's a list of 20 women who could come here and run circles around some of the other faculty members. And when they would refuse to do that, he left there. And so we just were so in awe of his leadership that we named our first organization Bell, Building Educated Leaders for Life. It was a tutoring and mentoring program, and started with 20 children, and we grew it to 15,000 scholars around the country. And part of the journey, though, as a social entrepreneur was, and this was a lesson I had to learn, I was always arguing with my donors, with my mom and dad who were advising me. I was saying, we just got to put more money in. We've got to do more for our kids because they just need so much to close these gaps, to overcome the obstacles that poverty puts in the way of our children. We've just got to put more and more. And those who were advising were saying, you've got to – I love the passion, but you've got to do it in a way that's sustainable. And so if you say to run a good summer program, it costs $10,000 per child, well, the school year program only spends $10,000 per child. And so you've got to make it sustainable. And so I think that, you know, again, I'm going a little bit off topic, but I just think that notion of the social entrepreneur is about how do you figure out a model that really, really has a positive effect and impact on children, in our case, education. Others are focused on environment. Others are focused on the criminal law system. Others are focused on other issues. And then how do you match that with an equally thoughtful, and this is where most of us in the social enterprise or social enterprise field fail is we don't put as much thought into how do we make sure that the business model, the consistently reliable revenue that we need to do the great work on the programmatic side is there. And that's what my mentors taught me, which is if you just focus on program, outcomes for children, you can do that, but you may be out of business in a year and a half. And you've got to focus on equally program, and how do we make sure that this is sustainable for children. And if you focus on it, honestly, most of us have the intelligence and the stick-to-itiveness and the love of children and the love of whatever our mission is, if it's not children, to actually figure out how can I do this in a way that makes sure that there's money next year and that there's money to pay the great staff that we need to serve our kids, and that there's money to have the curriculum that we need, and there's money to have expose our kids to the technology, and there's money to give our children the field trip experience and the other exposures that they need. And so that's the challenge of the social entrepreneur. And candidly, communities of color have more restricted capital for-profit ventures and for nonprofit than white communities. And so you have to be that much better in your strategy and in your approach to make sure that with the limited capital that you get, you're able to actually do what you have set out to do for children or for our community.
Now, Earl, this is Adia. I have a question because I just really find everything that you're saying is just very interesting, and you know, I guess never kind of thinking about things, certain things in a certain perspective. One of the things you mentioned was having a mentor.
Yes.
How do you think having a mentor helped you as far as when you look at it in relation to capital, when you're saying that capital is limited for a portion of Black people?
Well, I think my mentors did two things. One was network and networking to give me introductions to those who had the resources to help me launch my ventures. But the mentoring was also important in helping me rethink how I thought about running my nonprofit organization. And so one of the questions that Nate raised earlier is, hey, what are some of the critical lessons that the wealthiest people in this country have learned? There are two fundamental lessons. One is you pay yourself first. Every month when you get your paycheck, you don't pull out the electricity bill and the cable bill and the XYZ bill. No, you pay yourself first. And
yes,
the pay yourself first is you've sat down and said, I need to save this much for my future, and the future might be your children's college tuition, the future might be your retirement, the future might be peeling in and paying off your mortgage in half the time so you're not paying double in interest, but you're paying half in interest because you pay yourself first. And if you pay yourself first, that simple lesson is one that my mentors taught me, then all of a sudden, whoa, I don't have that much money left. So maybe I can't get HBO and Cinemax, I just have to get the regular cable package. Or maybe I can't order out an extra time, I've got to get something that I can heat up or cook at home. Or maybe I can't buy that extra suit or pair of slacks, but I've got to kind of go another 3 to 6 months because I can't afford to do that. And I think, so that's one piece. I think the second lesson that my mentors taught me, and I know, Adia, that's a little bit off your question, the second lesson that my mentors taught me is if you have a credit card, the credit card is only used for cash flow. It is not used to afford things that you cannot pay off immediately when that bill comes. And so if you're buying a television and you want that 52-inch television, and that's going to cost you several thousand bucks, and at the end of the month, you cannot pay that off, then please recognize you are paying 20% every month on that television, and by the time you've paid it off, you actually could have bought three televisions. That type of mentorship has been critical to me about, whoa, keep your costs down and live within your limits, live within your means, because then that will allow you to be in a position of financial strength in the future. And I think a lot of us have missed those critical lessons of pay yourself first, and if you have a credit card, it's only to cover you for 30 days, and if you can't pay it off in 30 days, then you can't afford it. Don't put it on your credit card, because you'll ultimately put yourself in a financial hole. And many Americans are in a terrible financial hole because of lack of understanding of how credit cards work and the rip-off situation you're in if you're carrying a 22% balance on a credit card for a meal, for a television, for a couch, month after month after month.
Wow.
You know, one of the things that I just thought about when you talked about savings is, you know, we've talked about savings a little bit over the last couple of years, and there's a scripture in Proverbs that talks about the ant and how the ant is wise, and nobody's really there guiding the ant. There's nobody over there, you know, overseeing it or ruling the ant. But what the ant does is the ant gathers what's needed in the summertime so that they have it later during the harvest time, or they have it in the winter time. And this is why we have these type of conversations, Earl, because the Bible, regardless of, you know, where somebody is in their faith, but the Bible has so many different principles in it that touch on all of these different areas of PRF, possessions, resources, and finances. And when we bring those things out, now it's up to the individual who actually hears this to do something with it. So for somebody who desires to be an entrepreneur but can't get their credit straight, and I'm not talking about having A1 credit, I'm talking about can't stop spending and over the limit fees and only paying the minimal balance, trying to get into being a social entrepreneur is even going to be harder, because it's going to be hard just being a regular entrepreneur. So we got to do some basic things. This was one of the things I want people to hear. We have to do basic things as a people in order to get to some of these places. You know, I think about the work that you do, and then I get saddened sometimes when I think about the church, just to be honest with you. Because, Earl, how many schools does PLA currently have? We may have lost Earl.
Oh,
well,
sorry.
Listen.
Right now,
go ahead.
Sorry, Nate. Right now, we have two schools that serve 750 children. Next year, please God, we'll have four schools that serve 1,500 children, and within 5 years, we'll have nine schools, and we'll serve a little under 10,000 children.
Now I want people to really, I don't know if people can even grasp that concept. But when I hear that, I say, I thank God for somebody like Earl, who is involved in this to help educate our children. Because you were able to step in where somebody else failed. Is that a fair assessment, I guess? I don't know. I don't want to be too hard on my language.
No, it is what it is. And our public schools have failed our kids. And some of the schools that we've taken over are schools that you wouldn't send your enemy's children to. They're hellholes. And we've been blessed to come into those schools and hire new teachers who love the kids and who believe in our scholars and who are absolutely high expectations for our kids, and turn those around and give our scholars the chance to be who God created them to be. So it's not too harsh at all.
And I like the word that you use. The teachers have high expectations. Well, I'm just the same way when it comes to the church. I look at some of the things going on in my community. I look at some of the things that's going on. I mean, the school system in Philly is horrible. I'm a product of it. It may have been horrible back then, and I made it out, but it doesn't mean that it still wasn't horrible. It was horrible. That's why I didn't go to Martin Luther King High School, and I went to Abraham Lincoln High School in a white neighborhood. because I didn't want to go to a place that I knew was horrible because I saw the people who were going to high school before I got there. And I think about, I'm always thinking about what is the church doing? Not necessarily this, you know, ABC church, you know, on 5th and L. I'm thinking about what is the universal church doing? What are all of these churches that's doing? What are all the churches in my community doing? And for a while, I used to always think that the church had a responsibility to do what you're doing, to make sure that the children are educated, and where society and government are failing, that the church should step in. But I've started moving away from that and started really realizing whoever's gifted enough, let them do it. Now, on top of that critique, or on top of that statement, I would say it only makes sense that those of us, quote unquote, in the church, that we will want to send our children to a PLA, to a PLA school, because we know that they have high expectations. And I met somebody that I'm going to, I guess in time, Earl, there will be an introduction, because the church in those communities, they have to support what you're doing.
Yeah,
it's not like they're the only, but from a black perspective, a black church perspective, or a black person perspective, in those inner cities particularly, if the black church doesn't embrace what you're doing, what y'all are doing, then where are we going to send, where are they going to send their children?
That's right.
To the other failing schools? And so then they go to the other failing schools. I mean, if you just turn on the news, kids coming to school with guns, fights in schools, a whole bunch of other foolish type of stuff that's going on. Well, if the church has their children in those type of schools, those things are going to affect them one way or the other. And it's going to be a part of how they grow up. So why not put them in a place where you know they're doing good things? And if we don't support it, who else is going to support it? And then I say on the flip side, we want people to support us as the church. But we got to show that same support. So this whole thing that I'm seeing from what you're doing and what we're doing here at PRF, it has to be supported by other people. And I think with one of the challenges of capital, for those who are listening that are already entrepreneurs, that are already doing things. I know a young lady who is an artist. And if anybody knows anything about being an artist, it is not one of those businesses that you're just flowing with cash all the time. But I know a young lady who is an artist who sticks with it, and I just keep watching her. And I know she's listening, so unless she presses one on her dial pad and she speaks up, and I'm not going to call her out. But she keeps going, and she keeps going, and she keeps doing shows, and she keeps doing shows. So then I say, okay, well, when we see that, when we see somebody who has that potential, then it's up to us as the community to attach on to what they're doing so we can help them. How long do we have to watch the Koreans do what they're doing before we get it? Earl, just hold on, y'all. We have a caller that wants to make a comment. So we have a caller here from Columbus, Georgia. Welcome to the PRF table.
How you doing, Dr. Dunlap? This is Wanda. I was about to cry. So just letting
you
know I was here. I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Actually working on a piece as we speak.
So for those of you who don't know, this is the artist that I was speaking about. Ms. Wanda Hill, so you have the microphone. If there's something that you want to ask Earl, I know you've been listening for a while, but if there's something that you want to ask Earl or even just put yourself out there, because unless we celebrate each other, we can't expect anybody else to do it. Everybody doesn't have – I mean, Earl, you talked about capital, right? Everybody may not have $500 to put inside of to invest in marketing right now. When you got to buy canvas and you got to buy paint, nobody knows how much paint costs. but you know how much it costs. So I'm going to give you this opportunity to put yourself out there and let people know who you are and what you do. And then I'm going to challenge everybody else that's listening to go out and support somebody who had enough courage to say, not just to say this is what I'm going to do, but to actually stick with it. So, Wanda, the floor is yours.
First, I'd like to say, Mr. Earl, I'm so astounded by your message, and I received everything you said, and I'm just honored to be on the, you know, on the phone listening to you, and I wish I had a mentor like you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the words that you said because it meant a lot. And,
thank you.
And Nate, thank you for this opportunity. I'm very honored and touched right now. Like Nate said, I am an artist, and I paint nearly every day. And I did not start out, you know, wanting to sell my pieces or anything like that. It was a type of therapy for myself, and my background is in counseling. But I do this full time now. My love for art has taken over, you know, and so I put myself out there this year. Well, last year, this month, February, be a year that I said, you know, this is what I'm gonna do. You know, people, you know, laughed at me, told me, you know, take it as a hobby. You're never gonna do any, you know, make, you know, any money per se, you know, with doing, you know, doing your art. But I didn't listen to them, and I still don't listen to them. I started doing shows. I did my first show in Orlando, Florida. I got great reception, and I was taken aback by my reception I got in Florida because I didn't get a reception like that back here at home. My first show I did here, Nate was the only person to this day still. Nate has been the only person in Columbus, Georgia, that have purchased a piece from me. And I feel like that's very significant. And I went to, and, you know, I've done a lot of, like, you know, First Fridays, you know, downtown. You know, I have my tent, be by myself. I have my tent, I have my table, I have my chair, I have all my art out there. And our people walk right by me. And, you know, that goes to somebody else. And I'm the only artist out there of color, you know, rain, sleet, shine. I'm the only one out there with color. And, you know, they'll walk right by me. And so, you know, I took my art to social media. I took it to Facebook first. And every day I tend to have a picture of the day. And other people started seeing my work, and people started wanting to buy my work, and I get messages how my paintings inspired them, or, you know, just, you know, I started doing like art shows and house parties and teaching kids how to paint. That's what my ultimate goal is. I want people to know that this is a type of therapy, a type of release that, you know, there's so much beauty in art. There's so much soul within art that it's so passionate that you just can't stop. And so with my pictures of the day, I've been able to sell through social media. I send out right now, I don't have a capital, so everything that I sell a painting, I take that money, I go to Michael's, I restock on my canvases, I restock on my paint, my brushes, and I get home, and I start another painting, you know. And I can do 2-3 paintings a week. It's just all according to what hits me, you know. I have my time that, you know, I can go a month long without a single thought or anything that comes to my imagination or feeling, because everything that I do is on an emotional basis, and I feel and I put everything in my paintings. But I've sold, last month, January, is a special month because it's the first time that I've sold 3 paintings in 1 month. And that's good for me. And I celebrate that. And like I said, but those three, one was sold in Virginia, one was sold in Mississippi, and one was sold in Afghanistan. You know,
wow.
That and my one that I was sold in December, that was sold in Texas. The one in November was Jacksonville, Florida. It's not here. It's not home. I did a show two Saturdays ago, and it was me and two other black artists. I found two black artists through doing shows around town. And, you know, we don't get publicity. So we brought these two artists together, and we put our money together, and we gave our own exhibit. And it was so successful. You know, it brought people out that never, you know, went to an art show or really talked to an artist and see what a painting actually means and that story and that meaning behind that painting. And they were so taken aback, and they were so, you know, interested in that. And I want to do more of that. I want to open up that studio. You know, I want to be able to bring kids in, bring adults in, bring couples in, and use my background in therapy to let them get their emotions out on that canvas. Because I know how it feels after I finish a painting, that release and that calmness that I get after I finish a painting. So I want to bring that to others. And Mr. Nate, he can tell you that I'm very passionate about my painting and want to get other people in the art. Now, every single day, my whole timeline is about art, other people painting. And then you can see people receiving their paintings and telling me that my painting that I painted was for them. And it's supposed
and
to be.
And Wanda, I want to, A, thank you so much for sharing. And then B, say, Wanda is the, you know, exemplifies that person who, candidly, the early me on the education, she's obviously focused on art, who was, I'm going to be all in on the social impact and giving that individual a chance to express themselves through their art. And Wanda, my only offering to you is, if I can be a support, the social entrepreneur is all about the impact, the social impact that you're so passionate about, your case art and what expression does for individuals, my case education. But if there's not that equal drive from somebody, doesn't have to be you, but somebody who's a partner on the business side, then oftentimes the business will often be struggling day to day to stay alive. And if I can give some support on you keep that passion, you keep that love, my God, the world needs so much more of that.
Yes.
But if your business is to be alive a decade from now, then at some point, my guess is, and I could be absolutely wrong. I don't know what the universe holds. I don't know what God holds for any of us. But my bet, if there are 100 organizations that have similar passion, obviously not the same as your incredible passion, but similar passion, I bet that 97 of them no longer exist because they ran out of resources, they ran out of time, life caught up to them, and it requires that social entrepreneur says, I'm going to keep that passion, but I'm going to find a way to make the business work, and I need either to be myself equally passionate about how do you make sure the economics of the incredible work that you're delivering is sustained, and not only sustained, but goes from 3 paintings to 30 paintings, to 300 paintings, right? And not just the paintings, but what individuals who are involved in your experience get to experience from a humanistic perspective. If you don't figure out the business side of that, then many, at least again, 99% of small businesses continue to be small businesses under a million, under 100,000, under 50,000 annual revenue, because they say all I'm going to focus on is the education. All I'm going to focus on is the art, and I don't know marketing. I don't know sales. I don't know pricing. Dirty terms for some. If they're dirty terms, then in many cases, unfortunately, our ability to take the incredible thing we're doing and grow it to touch 30, 300, 3,000, and 3 million people is lost. And so that's the resource, and Nate has my information and can share with whomever he wants, but that's the resource that I think the social entrepreneurship says. Double bottom line, your passion, and then how do you ensure it's profitable? And if you don't do the second, gosh, I've seen so many people burn out on the passion.
Right.
Wow, thank you. Thank you, Wanda. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Make sure we make that connection. So Columbus, Georgia, you have heard from somebody, and I'll say, Wanda, you are Black history.
Thank you.
You are Black history. Black, my sister. Girl, and that was the last place that I wanted to kind of hit on tonight, was really about the networks. Everybody's not fortunate enough to have these different networks and the resources that, you know, you may have or I may have in some different areas. So when it comes to getting capital, are there any reputable resources that are out there that have the mindset and the heart to help fund projects or to help people like Wanda to get to a better place without, you know, taking her to the bank, for lack of a better phrase?
So my short answer is I'll give an answer, but I'll give a process. And some people want the answer, but the people who are going to thrive and survive actually appreciate the process. So in the education space, if you're an early stage entrepreneur, you go to Echoing Green, ECHO Green Foundation, ING, sorry, ECHOING Green Foundation. You go to Draper Richards Foundation. You go to the Mind Trust. So I could give those, but again, it goes to, well, how much do you want it? If Earl has to come on and list where you can go to find startup capital, then I would contend you're not that passionate. I mean, given the internet, given the
right,
easy ability to find out, hey, here's somebody else in my space, artist, environmentalist, criminal justice person, education, here's another startup group. You can go to their website in 30 seconds and find their annual report and find their donor list, find their 990, if you're committed. If you're not committed, you say, oh, I'm not going to spend time doing that. I got to do what I'm passionate about. But part of me would say, if you're going to be successful, 9 out of 10 people, I don't need to tell you the names of the foundations. And again, I just shared the education space, a few in the education space. But you think about the process of who else's startup in my space, where did they get their resources? Let me research who that is. Let me research what they give to, how much they give. And like any small business, like any entrepreneur, in the early stage, yes, if you're a nonprofit, there's a philanthropic piece. But most of us, for-profit or nonprofit, our early stage investors are friends and family. And that's why I went to the notion of the Korean example, which is if you don't got friends and family who have any means, $5,000, $10,000, $50,000, $500,000 that you need to start your business. If you don't have that network, and we as a community don't say, I'm going to take a bet on this one, but it's not a gift. I'm not giving you a donation. You're going to pay it back, but I'm going to trust that you pay it back, and I'm going to win some and lose some. If we don't create those type of funds of friends and family, then a lot of us run into the problem that an entrepreneur has, which is I don't have any capital. I don't have any money for thinking about marketing. I don't have any money for thinking about developing a web presence that people around the world can figure out and come and find my art and access my approach. I don't have that. And so I'd say it's process, friends and family, and then really researching who gives to organizations that are startup in my space, education, arts, humanity, or what have you.
And let me tell you why I asked that question. I asked that question because I know there's some people that are out there listening, some people who are listening to the recorded show after we go off the air, and that's where a lot of people's mindsets are. You and I both already know that. It takes somebody to be able to say, look, you can't be lazy and think that it's going to just come to you. The first thing that you said was, you said there's an answer and then there's a process. And Adia, you can relate back to what we've been dealing with for the whole month of January, that healing is a process. We talked about process, 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 because this is not the type of ministry that's here to just tell you, oh, just pray about it, God's going to take care of it. Just pray about it, everything's going to be all right. No, we're not going to tell you that. We're not going to lie to you. Go through the process. I think one of the last things I said on last week's show was, if you want a miracle, pray to God for a miracle. If you want a healing, be willing to go through the process. And so that was just one of my, I guess, my journalistic type of questions to put out there so that we can get an honest answer, straight, no chaser. Look, you got to go through the process. So this whole thing about process is just keeps regurgitating. And then that leads me to this. Everybody may not have those friends or, excuse me, those family members that actually have, you know, the $5,000, $10,000, $50,000, $500,000 worth of capital. But I think there's a person that we all know by the name of Barack Obama. And I think I remember back in 2007, 2008, when he was running for president, that he got a lot of small donations. And a lot of those small donations to his campaign made a very big difference. And so, in my estimation, Earl, it's not about who can give you $500. Look, you know if your auntie does not have $500 to give to you, but she may give you $25. Somebody else may give you $50. And I think it might in the long run. And I think if we take it into a context of not trying to look for the big bang, right? Not looking to get all of it all at one time with this one person, or looking for the knockout blow, as I call it. Then after a while, just gathering those funds, I'm believing, will make an impact. So I hope everybody who's on there listening will really understand it's not about getting everything all at one time. It is about making sure you're working the networks. And I think also, Earl, there's some people who are just not social butterflies, right?
Yes.
They're not social butterflies, but we all got these people around us that has never met a stranger, right?
That's right.
Kathy is one of those people who has never met a stranger. So when it comes to asking for money, best believe I go reach out to Kathy and say, Kathy. Because people like her more than they like me, because, you know, she's sweeter than I am, I guess.
Nah. Maybe that's You're both equally. But Nate, to even take it a step further, it's not about social butterflies. It you know, Keith Sweat says, how deep is your love? And so the question is, how deep is your love for what you're trying to do? I hated fundraising when I started. Hated it. I thought the notion of going to beg white corporate executives for financial crumbs to serve black people, when I had hundreds of black classmates that were going out and making $250,000 a year and 5 years out were making $1 million a year, I thought the notion of going to beg mostly white corporate executives was the most disgusting thing that I could think of. Because it was a shame to our community that the talented 10th got through and all they could worry about was, you know, having a Range Rover and a Land Rover and a house that cost $750,000, house poor. That's what they were worried about. And I said, shame on you. Du Bois would be sick because you've taken the talented tenth and you've perverted it into, I'm going to get mine. And so I hated going to fundraise. And at one point I remember I was sitting and I had a chance to meet a hedge fund person here in Boston who had made $250 million in the year before I was going to ask him for some support. And I was so burned up. And I'm sitting in his office in his waiting room. And I'm in such a negative space. And I said, Earl, if you go in with this energy of being so angry about what the black community is not doing and that the fact that you have to go and beg another community for some crumbs to serve your kids, if you go in with that energy, you're actually not going to be successful. You're actually going to blow this opportunity that you've worked 9 months to get this meeting. And I asked the question. Wow. I said, what are you willing to do for black children? And my answer was, I am willing to die for black children. And I said, if you're willing to die for black children, shut the hell up, get your head in the right space, and go in and convince this individual to give you $1 million to support what you're trying to do for our kids. And so part of it is not just, am I comfortable? Does this feel okay? But part of it is a test. And I really believe it was God's test. Of Earl, you say your life is devoted to our kids. What fires will you walk through to show me that I should actually open up the gates of opportunity, the gates of financial resources, the gates of blessings to give you this? Because 1,000 people say they want to be rich, say they want to make an impact, say they want to give back. A million people say that, but I want to test you. How much do you really want? I really believe, looking back, that was God's test. And fortunately, I had that internal conversation that said, I will do anything short of I will die for my kids, and therefore I will get myself in the right space to do something that's completely outside of my comfort zone to raise money. And that donor gave us $1 million. But more importantly, I learned the lesson that I better shut up about, oh, my God, I'm so worried about doing this, or I don't want to do this. My issues, if I want to be an entrepreneur and I want to be a social entrepreneur that is really doing something special for kids. And we were able to grow our first organization to $27.5 million annual revenue. My schools won a $107 million per year contract to serve kids in public nonprofit charter schools in Indianapolis. And I don't think that happens if I didn't have that conversation about not my comfort zone, but what am I willing to do and proving to the universe, proving to God that I will walk through fire to help make this happen for our kids.
Wow. You know what? I think that is a perfect place to stop tonight. I really want people to just take that away from this show tonight. So, Earl, we're going to say thank you so much for being with us. If there's anything else that you would like to put out there, if there's anything that you would like to give to the listening audience, please take this opportunity to do so. And, again, we're thankful so much that you just took your time out of your schedule to be with us this night.
Thanks for the opportunity to share. You know, my name, as Nate said, is Earl Martin Phelan, Phalen. Anybody can find my contact information if you want to find it. It's very public on all my websites. And if I can help you and you're sincere about doing something special for our kids, I will help you.
Amen. Amen. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been blessed this evening to have this awesome guest and also our caller who called in. Take everything serious about what has been said tonight. Sometimes we have to, especially when we're talking about ministry, we're talking about authentic ministry. We have to sometimes move away from the Bible, but we can still stay close to God. So we didn't give you a bunch of scriptures like we may have walked through in previous shows. We just had to have not just conversation tonight, but dialogue. And so with that, we just have some guests that's going to be with us next week. Next week, Adia is going to be co-hosting or leading the show next week. Please come, and we hear the woo-hoos already in the background, so please come and be a part of that conversation. They're going to be definitely pressing in, and make sure you come with us. come with us on this journey for the rest of the month of February, not just because it's Black History Month, but because we're uplifting Black history. So let me just say, Earl Martin Phelan, you are Black history. Wanda Hill, you are Black history. And so with that, we're just going to say good night. We love you. Have a wonderful evening, and God bless.